Hello and welcome to Episode 8, the New Year edition of Notes from the ILC, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, as well as interviews with artists and creators across the county. Well, here we are in 2022. And to be honest, well, there's not that much going on right now. After the rush of the holidays, the new year takes some easing into. And so on this edition of the podcast, we're going to ease back into the swing of things by taking the opportunity to do a couple of extended interviews. While there's not much live performance taking place in the region, both the cinema series and the Live at the Met series here at the Opera House are getting right back into action. And I managed to get two incredibly knowledgeable and expert guests and have extended conversations with them about these two wonderful series. So stoke the fire, grab some hot tea or chocolate, put your feet up, and get ready for some interesting listening.
I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put that in. Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
We'll start off with the cinema series, and joining me to talk about the four upcoming movies for January is Mr. Paul Preston of The Movie Guys. An alumnus of SUNY Fredonia, Paul is based in Burbank, California, where he is involved in a myriad of activities too numerous to list related to everything Hollywood. He and I go over the four movies on offer this January. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have Mr. Paul Preston from The Movie Guys here to do the movie review for the coming spring season at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Paul, welcome.
Tom, thank you for having me on to talk about movies. It is a lifelong dream. Actually, it's not true. We have talked about movies a couple times in public where it's recorded in the past. But, you know, you're such a stage lover. I'm such a movie lover. It's often made for interesting conversations.
Yes. Well, I know we have to. We probably should clue our audiences into our ongoing, I won't call it a feud, but I'll call it an eternal discussion about the, you know, movies and theater. Maybe I'll let you recap that. How about that? You know,
well, I mean, I've loved movies ever since the Star Destroyer went over my head in Star Wars in 1977, you know, in the theater. It was larger than life. It was the most amazing thing I ever seen. I wanted to be a part of it. And so I went to acting school. And then Tom says, the stage is where magic happens, you know, and you're right. I love them both. But I just always have enjoyed how you think, you know, the acting is watered down in movies and the real emotions can't quite be put together as well as when it's right in front of you and live and all that. It's always made for a great discussion.
Yeah, it always made, I know, you know, I think the basis is that I've always seen theater as an actor's medium. I've always seen movies as a director's medium. I think to me, that just makes the difference. And but that I think doesn't, for me anyway, take away from the wonderful time one can have going to see the movies. I mean, it's not like I don't go to see the movies, but I like to make sure that when I go to see a movie, I'm going to see a good one. So that anytime I need to know whether a movie is good, I call Paul Preston and I ask him and he'll tell me.
It looks like you get a good slate coming to the Opera House. So.
Yeah, it does, actually. I think this is a pretty interesting slate, these four movies. All of them are going to be in January. At least for this particular part, I'm sure there are going to be more movies coming in the spring, and maybe I'll get you back to talk about those when we get them. But let's roll down them. The four movies that we're going to talk about here are Belfast with Kenneth Branagh, Julia, which is a documentary on the life of Julia Childs, Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I can't decide is a reboot, a new boot, what kind of boot it is, but Paul will tell me. And of course, West Side Story, which has been the ideal from Steven Spielberg for a long time, taking the classic 1959 musical and turning it into a movie. So let's kick it off with Belfast. Now, you probably know that I'm a big Kenneth Branagh fan, and I'm particularly because of the movies that he's done, Henry V, Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing, terrific movie that he was in. And he's getting a reputation not only as as an actor, but also as a very good film director. Do you see that in this film that he's directed?
Well, yes, we both agree. I think Henry V is the best script adaptation of Shakespeare to screen that there is. I mean, I know Hamlet's Laurence Olivier's Hamlet won Best Picture, but you know, filmmaking progressed, acting got more realistic as time went on, and I just thought Branagh knocked it out of the park with Henry V.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, and so I enjoyed that much more than watching him kind of languish in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or what he, his last thing was Artemis Fowl, this children's adventure book adapted for Disney Plus, which was a big, he shows his finest attributes as a filmmaker when the material is in his wheelhouse. You know, Much Ado About Nothing, you mentioned that as well. He directed and starred in that, and that's fantastic. And that's what Belfast is. It totally in his wheelhouse, because he was encouraged to write the script about his own childhood back in 1960s Belfast, when there was Protestants and Catholics at each other's throats, and anyone can make a movie about just that and the history of it, and it could be fascinating. But he instead tells a story of a boy, you know, himself, trying like hell to be a boy during all of that. So yeah, he hasn't written a script since 06. So that was clearly, I'm always a fan of the director driven movie. Too many movies are just sort of attaching a director. Right. But when you see somebody's behind something from the get-go, I mean, you can tell the work, the love, the everything is up on the screen. That's certainly the case with this movie. No, and you have great performances. I mean, a laundry list of fantastic. Judi Dench, this is his sixth collaboration with her. Surprise, she's great. And and the lead, one of the lead actors, Jamie Dornan, he was in a great television show called The Fall, a superb Irish TV film where he plays a serial killer and Gillian Anderson is coming after him. Great movie, and a great TV show, and he's great in it. And I'm like, oh, I can't wait to get more of this guy in the States. So he came to the States and he starred in the 50 Shades of Grey movies. No, no. So he's excellent here. Finally found a good role for him that shows all that he can do. And he's excellent here. He just got a Golden Globe nomination. So did Kieran Hines as the grandfather of the young boy. One of those two is no doubt headed for an Oscar nomination as well. And he got Jude Hill playing Buddy, the young boy who is the Kenneth Branagh type in the story, a 9-year-old boy. And Catriona Balfe, maybe? I can't quite pronounce her name, plays her mother as well, but plays his mother as well. And so there's a whole bunch of new actors in here that I've never seen or don't know, from the young boy to the mother, and a lot of the ancillary characters who are all excellent.
So. You know, 1969 was especially in Belfast, Ireland, was a year of terrible violence. And I'm wondering if the movie, how the movie plays into that particular time frame. Does it, you think it softens it up? Do you think it gives it the right punch relative to the impact on the young Kenneth Branagh? How is that working in the movie?
Yeah, so that's the backdrop for everything. And the boy's trying to meet a girl, steal some candy, go to the movies. And so it's there the whole time surrounding him. And meanwhile, it's right at his house in the form of adults. He's trying to threaten the boy's father, Jamie Dornan's character, into joining them with us or against us, that whole thing. So that conflict happens with the adults, and the boy's just trying to be boys. So it's always there. Belfast, tanks on the streets. So it's, you know, and he wanted to show that, and he doesn't shy away from, you know, shaking up the camera a bit and making it, you know, the more kinetic action sequences when there's people throwing Molotov cocktails and big borders being set up with armed guards and everything, and then bringing it down to nice, sweet close-ups when it's time to do some family stuff. So yeah, it's both there in a nice contrast, and it's all shot in black and white as if to show this is a memory.
Except for
splashes of color here and there. And this movie guy, of course, is very happy when those splashes of color happen during the film. So keep your eye out for that. It's very enjoyable.
Okay, so Belfast, the story of a 9-year-old boy trying to still be a boy while all the violence between the Protestants and the Catholics are going on in Belfast in 1969.
But Tom, I should tell you, we were talking about this before you started recording.
Yeah.
You're going to want to turn on the closed captioning. So you're not going to get that in the theater. So in the theater, pay attention. Thick Irish dialects, and you'll want to follow along. So,
okay. All right. I'll make sure to bring my hearing aids to that one. That'll help a lot. All right. The next one we've got after that on the 15th of January is the documentary Julia, By Julia Childs, of Julia Childs. And I hadn't even realized there was a documentary made of her life. Of course, when I first looked at it, I thought it was the film starring Meryl Streep, but you corrected me and said, no, no, there was a documentary made about her. And I said, oh, fascinating. She was a fascinating woman. What did you find about this particular movie that stood out for you?
Well, I watched Julie and Julia with Meryl Streep and I enjoyed it, but I always thought that maybe her life deserved a life-spanning film. Mm-hmm. But I knew less about her than I thought once I watched the film. Ah. And then after seeing the film, absolutely her story needed to be told. I mean, there's an overall charm to Julia Child. If you've ever seen any of the clips of her on her, you know, what was it called? The French Chef, I think.
French Chef was her TV show. Yeah. So,
yeah. And, but you know, there's of course a way that she was socially impactful as well. That was fascinating to watch, and the documentary told all that stuff. But the biggest relief is, can I swear on this show?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. You can make put a beep in or something. What a relief is that this, you don't learn that she's a tremendous ass. Because all biopics, that's what I learn about the, you know, you watch the Johnny Cash movie. Yeah, it turns out he's a drug addicted jerk. Hank Williams, turns out he's a waste of space drug addict. Jimi Hendrix, turns out he's a careless philanderer, doesn't care about anybody. Ray Charles, jerk. I mean, it's tiring. So like, I love these people. Who doesn't love Jimi Hendrix? Turns out he's a jerk. You know, all these movies are excited to tell you what a jerk they are.
Right.
Whether they're biopics or documentaries. And this one, Julia is, there's one scene where she like has to be kind of cold seeming because she has to make a decision about her career that affects other people. Seems a little unkind, but that's it. Other than that, she patches up things with that person anyway later. So overall, if you love Julia Child, you'll love the movie because she just comes across as the person you think she is, even going through all the archival footage. No dirt. Turns out she's lovely and talented and charming. So that's the part. There was one point I found very interesting. They talked about how many of the chefs who made up her fan base were gay. Mm-hmm. And Julia talked about how there are a lot of homos in the audience today. This is just a product of her generation. Mm-hmm. She realized, well, eventually her lawyer was gay, died of AIDS. And so what does she do? Reverses course on her whole thinking about that. And she publicly spoke about how AIDS patients need more care from the society that we all live in together. And she held dinners to raise money for charities, et cetera. It's called evolving. And you got to see that in this film. It's not a huge part of the movie, but it's a little moment that I enjoyed. And it got me sad to think about how hard it is today for someone to be able to do that. You know, with the noisy online mobs, you say one thing, career over, you're done. That's it. You don't get the turnaround. And so it was interesting to see her realize, wait, what have I been saying? And who are these people that I love? And how are these people hurting? And oh, I should, regardless of how I grew up, change this thought. And you know, that kind of thing I found fascinating to watch as well. Maybe the 70s and 80s were an easier time to do that.
What did you think about the cinematography relative to the cooking, the food, how'd that go over? That's got to be something. I mean, she was a hell of a cook.
Hungry.
Yeah.
even if you're not, you're going to leave hungry, because many of the dishes that she talks about in archival audio, or some of the people in the testimonials talk about dishes they made with her, they don't always have archival footage for that, or maybe it's black and white or something. So they recreate some of these dishes with slow-mo HD glorious shots of the pan flipping and the meat and potatoes and the sauce just flipping around. It's divine. So yeah, all that's wonderful. But overall, the doc is very well put together. It doesn't do anything particularly radical. It just has a nice mix of talking heads and archival footage. Child's voice herself often guides you through much of it, no doubt taken from interviews, and it's laid over other footage. And the clips from her TV show will have you cracking up, because she was a hoot. And again, Eastwood put out a movie this year, Clint Eastwood, called Cry Macho. I didn't get to see it, but I want to, because I love the idea that he's 91 and he's still making movies. You know why? Because when you do what you love, why would you want to retire? Julia Child did her thing right up until she died, until she was 91. So if nothing else, get inspiration from that out of this doc.
Okay. Julia, January 15th. I think the following week, January 22nd, Ghostbusters Afterlife. Now, I know. I know, Paul, that you are a huge Ghostbusters fan. I know that. I know Bill Murray is I think he's your favorite actor, if I recall correctly. And
he's my favorite comedic actor, probably. I mean, Harrison Ford still.
Okay. You are like, I couldn't think of another person to ask about, you know, what did you think about Ghostbusters Afterlife? So you have to explain this to me, because as I understand it, it's not quite the Ghostbusters routine, but it's something completely different related to, it's like a rediscovery of the Ghostbusters mystique by some young kid somewhere. Am I correct?
That is correct. But this is the first sequel to Ghostbusters 2, 32 years in the making. So very exciting to have this story continue on. As you may know, Ghostbusters in 2016 with Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Leslie Jones, Kate McKinnon, that was a sort of, I don't know what, alternate timeline or something. It was reboot. This is a continuation of the story. And if you want, that's tough to catch lightning in a bottle like you did with the original Ghostbusters. This is one of the top three funniest movies I think ever made, right up there with Airplane and Blazing Saddles. Just for quantity of jokes. Insane, right? Plus, you got the three comedians at the top of their game, save with Ivan Reitman, the director. But you watch the trailer for Ghostbusters Afterlife, and it's not that funny. It plays out more like Stranger Things meets Ghostbusters. So if you're watching the trailer correctly, then you know what you're in for when you go to see the film. And this plays out just like that. It's more of a Spielberg movie. Hmm. You know, you got young kids. Goonies, Lost Boys, E.T. I mean, it's all kids on bikes discovering and having adventures. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is kind of about. So, Tom, you knew my late wife, Karen Volpe. We were both Fredonia students, mm-hmm. and she died in 2019. And we went to a Ghostbusters fan fest because she outdid me for Ghostbusters.
Well, yeah, she did.
So we had to go to this fan fest one time only, 35th anniversary of the original film at the Sony lot here in Los Angeles. And Jason Reitman is introduced as the director of the new movie. It had already been announced that he was doing it, but this is the first time he's like coming out and speaking about it. And he's there with Ivan Reitman, the original Ghostbusters director, and his father. And he says, you know, I want to make this movie for the fans. But even more so, which is never a good sign, by the way. But he said, but even more so, I want to make it for you, Dad. You're the best storyteller I know. And I just want to keep this going. I'm like, that's what I wanted to hear. Okay. So this is better. And his envision for the movie, the first thing he said he visioned when he wanted to make the film was a young girl in a field with a proton pack. Now, this franchise has needed to get out of New York City for a while now. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing every time. So taking it into the countryside is fantastic. But, I knowing Karen, a movie about a young girl wearing glasses, living in the countryside, who gets to be a Ghostbuster.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's it hit me right in the heart, as you can imagine.
Oh yeah.
So, it leans on crowd pleasing nostalgia, occasionally a little too much. So actually in the end, it was the new stuff I really enjoyed the most. I mean, and that works to the film's benefit. You have this young girl, Phoebe, more Phoebe, please. I wanted more and more Phoebe. She was great. She's got a friend in school named Podcast. Why? Because I have a podcast. And they're getting to the bottom of how the Ghostbusters tie into Phoebe's family. So it's totally that 80s kids gang doing stuff, you know, the young detective gang. And they figure all this stuff out about how she is actually related to Harold Ramis's character, Egon Spengler. So It's, like you said, an extension of the story. And to me, that works a hell of a lot better in recent days than a reboot. Mm-hmm. Creed, right? Creed is a fantastic continuation of Rocky. Blade Runner 2049 was more interesting than just remaking Blade Runner, because you're not going to remake Blade Runner better. So
right.
Tell us more, and brings back Harrison Ford. Jurassic World was a big hit with fans. Star Wars The Force Awakens was a massive hit. This fared better than Total Recall, Poltergeist, Fright Night, Ben-Hur, RoboCop, Flatliners. There was a Charlie's Angels remake in 2019. Those are all remakes. But mm-hmm. when I mention them, you're thinking of Arnold. You're thinking of Spielberg, right? You're thinking of Chris Sarandon and Fright Night. Thinking of Charlton Heston and Ben-Hur. Or, you know, you're not thinking of the remakes, but they came out because they're like cynical nostalgia grabs. But this one is the right way to go. And continuing the story was smart. well, it's a crime. We haven't had like 9 Ghostbusters movies. I mean, what a franchisable concept. You know, in fact, when the 2016 Ghostbusters came out with the female cast, I just wish they said it in Boston. Hey, we got ghosts. We got the founding fathers coming back and giving us out, you know, whatever. My friend wrote a spec script for the Ghostbusters coming to Los Angeles because they're making a movie about them. So they have actors playing the Ghostbusters. The real Ghostbusters are consultants until old movie stars and old haunted movie sets go nuts and they have to get the real Ghostbusters to save them. I mean, there's so many ideas, and this is only the fourth Ghostbusters movie we've had in 36 years. No, that's not right. This is a fun concept we should be playing with a lot more. So hopefully now with this movie being a hit, because thankfully they didn't spend a ton of money on it. This one spent like $50-60 million less. So it's already made its money back double plus, et cetera. So hopefully we see a lot more.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in, actually. We've got two lead-ins for the last movie we've got, which is West Side Story. One of them is, we have already mentioned Steven Spielberg twice, and also we're talking about how well the movie is or isn't doing at the box office. But let's talk about West Side Story. It's obviously an iconic musical. It was followed up by an iconic film from 1961, very quickly after the musical came out. And, you know, it's been part of, I think it's been part of, you know, the American psyche for any number of years, probably close to 50 years now. Stephen Sondheim just recently died, who was the lyricist for the original show on Broadway. There's a lot of baggage that this West Side Story is carrying around. And So give me your impressions about this. I understand that it's an absolutely glorious movie. It's well shot. It's actually probably pretty well acted. Spielberg has directed the heck out of it, and yet it tanked at the box office. What's going on?
I can't tell you why it didn't make money. I mean, it seems like the big name director is there, the high concept everybody loves title right there. Who doesn't love West Side Story? You've probably seen it on stage at some point. So why didn't it work? I mean, you got me. And it's the opposite of what we talked about. They remade it. They didn't continue it. I mean, we don't need to continue it. But it's not a continuable story.
Right.
But it is, you know, let's do a prequel. Riffs. When Riff was a kid, you know, we don't need that. Mm-hmm. So I always struggle with remakes like this because I always felt like if it goes to film, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I had a buddy who wanted to put, a lot of times actors come out to LA and they're like, hey, I need to put a reel together, but I haven't done anything. So let's shoot some stuff and make a reel. And I always say, okay, we'll shoot some things and make it look like a web series or a short film or something where someone took a chance on you and you delivered in this role. And then whoever's watching this should also take that chance on you. And he's like, cool. Can I do the monologue from A Few Good Men? I'm like, no, Jack Nicholson did the monologue from A Few and it's done. Like he close the book. That's done. You can't do that. Right. So I agree more with Siskel and Ebert, who said remake bad movies. Give those ideas another shot. Mm-hmm. You know, so remaking West Side Story it is a tall order, especially until Titanic, the biggest, you know, or Lord of the Rings, maybe the biggest Oscar-winning film of all time, and
the original,
the original, the 1961 version.
Well, let's talk about the actual movie then. Well, you saw the actual movie. What did you think about
it? I did actually enjoy it.
Okay, good.
Despite all that. So I was like, yeah, because again, the risk of it not going well was huge. I think he's the reason why this worked so well. And in lesser hands, it may not have worked for me. One of the main reasons, I think, is he kept the danger intact. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't some musical theater danger where, you know, the stakes and the acting are watered down. Like the characters, even though they're singing and dancing, we're in the midst of some real danger with this from the police and with this gang war. And I thought that worked out very, very well. And he delivered it with a wallop. The other thing of the performances, I want to shout out some names I never heard of before. David Alvarez is Bernardo and Mike Faced plays Riff. Never heard of him, never saw him before. And sure enough, when I looked, they got theater creds, Tom. They got theater creds. Tony was the Tony winner David Alvarez was a Tony winner for Billy Elliot, and Mike Faced was Tony nominated for playing Connor in Dear Evan Hansen. So these guys had stage cred. They brought it to this film, and I thought they both looked perfect for the part. This guy, Mike Faced, especially his Riff, just looks like he was pulled right out of some 1960s, you know, like thing with the, you know, with the vest and everything.
Right.
And there's nothing that makes me cringe more than the words YouTube star, but that's what that's where Spielberg found Rachel Zegler, and she's quite good at the role. And of course, she sings her own songs, you know, Natalie Wood. So she's got real chops. Ansel Elgort as the lead would be the only one I'd say is just okay. He's definitely the singer I think brought the least to the material, but doesn't matter. Spielberg's got this. They wisely use hindsight. Like, you may know the old film was shot where Lincoln Center was going to be built.
Correct.
In the West Side, but it was all crumbling and rubble.
That's the neighborhood that my father grew up in, by the way.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, just as a side note. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was he in a gang? Because
No, he was. There were no gangs in the late 1930s, early 1940s. Oh, not quite yet. But you know, he grew up right in that neighborhood.
Well, this film starts out with a sign showing you projected like Lincoln Center coming, and they pan up from that, and there's the rubble where they just destroyed all these people's houses to make room for this new change. And of course, no one wants the change. Everybody's angry, and now you see where the gangs come from. And so that was cool to use hindsight to sort of people fighting so hard for this mess of a place. But of course, there's pride involved and everything. And again, it's all that sort of plotting. Tony Kushner wrote the script too, so he's not slacking on any way to sort of make this all, and again, I keep railing a musical theater, but he just makes it real heartfelt stakes. You know, none of that stuff is lessened because they sing and dance.
Right. Well, that's always been my, you know, I've directed the show twice myself, but that's always been the way I've gone about it, is it has to be directed. It has to be gritty, and it has to be tough. I've seen too many productions of West Side Story where everything is pretty and everything is, you know, feathery. And I throw up at those productions. So you've got to have that grit. And if you don't have that grit, I think you're really missing the whole point of the show, because that's where these people live. It meant something to them, and you have to get it on the, whether you get it on the stage or whether you get it on the movie, you really have to buy in that these kids are really serious about what's going on. That's really probably part of the key. Any particular interesting cinematic shots or anything like that, like particularly from the dancing, the choreography, or anything along those lines that you picked out?
Production designer's name is Adam Stockhausen.
Thank you.
His name, because he again built an incredible set. And Janusz Kaminski, longtime cinematographer for Spielberg, won Oscars from like Schindler's List on, you know, most every time he's nominated. He's brilliant, and he somehow radically makes this movie look like it's shot in the 1960s. It looks like it was shot like the old West Side Story. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously changes in lighting, you know, better lighting, but so all the scenes look magical, splashed with color, you know, especially like the school dance, you know. I think I liked America the most, because it starts with the girl singing about America, jumps out onto the street, and then just becomes a full-fledged number involving all the members of the community. And I thought that particular number with the costumes and the photography, and of course, great performance. Ariana DeBose as Anita, excellent. So that was probably the high point musically for me.
Great.
But I love to say that the high point overall is the drama of it all. And again, I think that's keeping that intact is the key to the film.
Yeah, well, I would agree. If it didn't have that, it really wouldn't be worth all the money they would sink into it in a remake. I wish it was, you know, I'm depressed that it hasn't made more money, that people haven't gone out to go see it, because it's a timeless story. I mean, so, you know, that I think is a shame. So, you know, I'm trying to encourage as many people to get out and see it as I possibly can, because I think it's going to be worth their time and effort. This is not a poorly made movie by any means.
And just watch it probably the trailer.
Deserves a better fate at the box office, I think.
Yeah, just watch the trailer. The photography is stunning, and it remains that the more you see it when you see the full feature.
Tell us a little bit about, before we go, just tell us a little bit about the Movie Guys. What's that all about? I mean, if people went to themovieguys.net, what are they going to get?
Well, right now we have a week, like, we want to do what the young kids are doing. So we're doing a streaming show, my friend Adam and I. Adam Witt's been with the Movie Guys for, you know, 10 plus years as well. I started the whole website just when I was writing reviews and sending them to friends, and people said, stick it on a website. So I started doing that. And now it's become podcasts and articles and interviews and red carpets and all sorts of fun stuff you can find on there. And the weekly show is now called Movie Nonsense. And we just chime in every Monday at 3 o'clock to talk about Pacific, to talk about whatever we feel like chatting about, what we saw that week, usually what trailers came out. And but we've had guests as well. We had the showrunner for Chicago Party Ant, a new Netflix show. We hope to have Mark Povinelli, a friend of mine who's in Nightmare Alley, coming on soon. And yeah, we've had other friends of ours who compete in the Movie Trivia Schmodown, which is this online movie trivia league that Adam and I are involved in. They have tens of thousands of fans. They watch us play movie trivia because they wisely added the elements of World Wrestling Federation to it. So like we're these larger than life characters, we have storylines and alliances and we smack talk. It's all weird and crazy, but people love it. So between that and Movie Nonsense, oh, the last thing I'll plug is the Ford Fiesta. My friend Adam and I realized we haven't seen every Harrison Ford movie that's ever come out. So let's do that. Starting with Dead Heat and a Merry-Go-Round, going all the way up to Call of the Wild. We're now watching everyone, each episode devoted to each show, a super deep dive with special guests and talking about all the films of my favorite movie star ever.
Great. Great. Thanks a lot, Paul. I really appreciate the time. And listen, you take care. Have a good new year, by the way. And I'm looking forward to your Oscar rant. I'm sure that'll be coming up pretty soon.
Yes, I always do a far too long rant about every category because they always get it wrong.
Yeah, but I love it every year. Yeah. You take care and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Tom.
These cold winter months are a great time to come indoors and see a good film. So be sure to get to the Opera House and check out these wonderful movies. All Paul Preston approved. Information on the cinema series is on the website at www.fredopera.org, or you can call the box office at 716-679-1891 to grab your tickets. If you want to see and hear more of Paul Preston's funny and incisive takes on the movies, just head on over to www.themovieguys.net. He'll steer you right. The other series beginning is the Live at the Met series, an extraordinary collection of live performances broadcast in HD from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. It's difficult to overstate how lucky the Chautauqua region is to have this series, and I want to take the time to give a shout out and my personal thanks to Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver, who are the underwriters of this fantastic series. They are giving to this region an experience you couldn't get even if you went to the Metropolitan Opera and saw a live performance, what with the interviews with performers and other creative artists, as well as the backstage looks during intermissions. Bravo, gentlemen, and thank you. My guest for the overview of the Live at the Met series is Ms. Julie Newell, Distinguished Teaching Professor of Voice at SUNY Fredonia. A stunning soprano in her own right, Ms. Newell is also the former producer of the annual Hillman Opera and has recently spent time working as a producer in her hometown for the Syracuse Opera Company. This interview will be presented in two parts, with the first four operas of the series being discussed in this episode and the last three discussed in the next episode on January 19th. Here's part one of this interview with Julie Newell. Julie Newell, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. It's really a great honor and a great privilege. And, you know, you and I have a background doing opera together. So it's great to have someone that I partnered with in the past to talk about these fantastic operas in the Live at the Met series.
And it's great to talk to you, Tom. We most certainly have history in our opera worlds together. We won't say the date when we did our first one, though. We don't want to scare.
No, I don't want to say
how long ago that was.
No, and I don't want to say how inexperienced I was when I first did
for
that.
For me, wearing the producer hat. Holy cow! Yeah. Singing's one thing, producing's another.
Yes, it is. Oh, yes, it is. Boy, we've gone through some things with that. Okay, so so the Live at the Met series is really a fantastic thing. I think I've seen a couple of them, and they're really wonderful to watch. I mean, the video, the you get an experience that's like nothing else. And so you and I just are going to take a little time here and preview all of the operas that we have coming up at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House between now and pretty much the end of June. So I know that I'm going to be taking some deep dives with some other people from the Chautauqua Institute and so on. You hopefully will come back to talk about some of these, but right now let's just do a real overview so we get the audience familiar. And we're going to start with Cendrillon, Massenet's Cendrillon, Cinderella. I think this is a holiday holdover, yes?
Yes, it is. So they had a radio broadcast on New Year's Day, and then they're rebroadcasting it on HD. It's a shortened, somewhat shortened length. It's by Massenet, and it stays in very predictable ways, close to the familiar Cinderella story. I know that in the Saturday radio performance that they had on New Year's Day, they had a lot of children in the audience, which is a goal of theirs. But with that in mind, the length of the opera has been reduced to more of a 2-hour opera. So it's a little bit more family friendly in that way. It's also sung in English quite unexpectedly, I would say. And that's a real challenge. And this is where the HD productions are so advantageous, I think, for us as audience to see, because of the way in which the sound is captured for the HD, you actually are able to understand the English.
And I know that they also do English with English subtitles. So even in a 4,000 seat hall, you'll still have the subtitles, I believe, on the HD
presentation. Correct. And that's gotten to be a way of the world. I mean, we even do that here in Fredonia so that people can choose how they want to perceive the language. I just always want to make sure that we do everything possible for people to visually take in the story and to really experience the story. But we don't want anyone to be losing what's going on in the text, especially when you get into arias that are expansion of the emotional value of the character as opposed to the storyline itself.
One of the unusual things too, just to let the audience know, is that you actually have two mezzo sopranos singing the lead roles. You have Isabel Leonard singing the princess, but you also have the mezzo soprano Emily D'Angelo as Prince Charming. How does that come across?
Right. So that actually goes back to it. It harkens back to the idea of pants roles that we're most familiar with in the Mozart operas, most notably Cherubino, where it was used originally to convey a certain youthfulness. But in this case, and in this case, it does something similar so that you have orally or acoustically a youthfulness that maybe draws the childlike sense of the story out, the level of innocence. The way in which the Cinderella story is told in the Massenet is, I find it very interesting in that it retains a magical quality, which is why children and adults like it. But it's not just a fairy godmother. There's the fairy godmother who's this amazing coloratura soprano. And so the vocalism, you know, speaks to her magical qualities. But there's a whole bunch of fairies, kind of Midsummer Night's Dream like. There's a whole bunch of fairies that come in that help to further the circumstances for Cendrillon or for Cinderella as she moves forward. What I love about the opera is that as opposed to, you know, your Disney Cinderella, which was my first movie ever for my birthday, age 5, is that arias, because the structure of opera are by their very nature, that thing in which we really learn about the emotional feelings of a character. And you don't get that in your Disney Cinderella. I mean, we know she's happy, we know she's sad, but we don't get an extension of feelings in, interestingly enough, a more adult or certainly a more human way that takes a fairy tale and transitions it from a beautiful picture to something that actually reveals the human experience of, you know, love. Am I going to find them? Am I going to find the happiness? And who are these ridiculous people that keep getting in my way? Now, of course, we know Cinderella you know, the stepsisters and all of their crazy people. And Massenet is so brilliant in us always having character music. They're always moving fast. Everything in the orchestra is going, you know, they're just talking and talking all the time while right. they're being, you know, in a non-aggressive way, nasty.
So that should be pretty nasty, enjoyable. And if you want to
nasty extend the, siblings,
if you want to extend the holiday season, it should be a nice little treat, because I'm sure that the, I'm sure that the visuals are going to be, you know, fairy tale fantastic, because the Met always does that. On January 29th, we now get to some serious bel canto singing. We have Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi, and this is, you know, one of the great operas of the Western canon. What do you find about this particular opera that's so compelling?
Well, again, it's what I feel like, I'll use the word suckers, not in a bad way. I feel like we are all suckers for, or at least drawn to, you know, a story of people who are trying to make the right decisions and then make bad decisions, and Rigoletto is all about that on every possible level. So, of course, Gilda has been, the soprano has been, you know, really faked out by thinking that the Duke of Mantua is a student, nice guy next door, nice person for her to go out with. She's been protectedly overprotected, doesn't really know who he is. And her father is really slow out of the gate of comprehending the potential pain of his relationship to the Duke of Mantua, his subservience. What I think is really interesting about this Met HD is it's a brand new production set in the 1920s.
Yeah.
The scenic and the costume elements have already won Tony Awards. I love to see that from opera. You're a theater guy, Tom, you know, and for so many years, there's been this language about separating opera from theater. And, you know, you and I both ascribe to exactly the opposite about that.
Yes.
So when I see the word Tony Award next to the Metropolitan Opera, it really, it's a wonderful indication to me of how opera is shifting and changing to be produced as theater and to have audiences embrace it as theater.
Yeah, we
not
should.
A concert.
And it's. Let's be clear. There are 11 Tony Awards.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good.
Yeah, that's really good.
You know, it's interestingly set in this between World War I, World War II. By moving it to that turbulent time politically, we're able to see it and understand in a 20th century way, in a more contemporary way, those power struggles and the strictures placed upon people in their lifestyle, depending on who they worked for, depending on who they fell in love with or who they had power over.
Yeah, and you know, it's just to get the audiences, perhaps to even get them to visualize it even more. It's the same era that Cabaret was set in, the area between World War I and World War II, the late 20s, early 30s. And I'm sure Bartlett Scherr, who's the director of this particular production and comes from a theatrical background, you know, had that in mind when he, you know, restaged it into that area. I think it should work very well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the singing's fantastic.
We've got, Quinn Kelsey is doing
a
role.
Yes, it's his debut. It's his debut at the Met. That's something I wanted to just take a moment to talk about. So the word debut is such an interesting one in the world of international opera, right? Because when we see the word debut now, it's like, oh, it's their first time out of the gate. Well, no, this is definitely not Mr. Kelsey's, you know, first time singing Rigoletto. And the importance for an international artist, for any artist, but in this international setting to continue to take the way in which you have crafted a role over multiple productions in multiple countries and multiple theaters that has garnered such respect, to have the Metropolitan Opera call you and say, we want you to bring your Rigoletto. I think that from a singer's point of view, that's a really fascinating component, because you're identified with a role and you bring it to the theater. That's a different kind of of a debut than someone who is a Met regular, who's on the roster, if you will, of the Met, who has their first performance in a role at the Met. They're different animals, and might be interesting for people that aren't necessarily in the opera business to experience the subtleties of what that language means in artistically.
Yeah. And they've got Rosa Faola is Gilda, and tenor, I can't even pronounce his name, I think Piotr Bezala.
Bezala. I'm not sure, I should look that up, how you pronounce C to Z, but it might be Bezala.
Yeah, it might
I
be
apologize, I don't know.
Okay, so that's Rigoletto. That's going to be on the 29th of January. And then we get an opera that I'm not really all that familiar with, and which I find very, I'd like to direct this someday, but Adriani auf Naxos. It seems to be two things in one.
At least two.
What's going on here, Julie?
Yes. Okay. I'm gonna preface this and brag ever so slightly that I had the privilege of singing in a production of Ariadne off Naxos out in Long Beach, California, a long time ago, in what was the original version of the work. So the Met's advertising it as an opera within an opera. That's what you usually say about Ariadne. But its genesis was back in 1912, when Strauss was asked to create 30 minutes of opera to conclude Molière's play, a full performance of Molière's play,
Le Bourgeois Jean Dion. Yeah.
So the whole play, and then the whole play ends with this 30-minute opera. Well, as these things go, as you well know, it morphed into 90 minutes.
Oh, my.
So the first time it was presented, they presented it in its entirety. So all of Le Bourgeois Jean Dion, all of this 90-minute opera, and it ended up being like a five-hour day-night. And it wasn't, you know, they premiered it multiple places, but it was not audience friendly in that way. And one of the funniest things, this funniest statements when I was reminding myself of it, is that they just couldn't see how opera singers and actors could, you know, really be in the same work. And that totally, it totally cracked me up. I was like, okay, well, there you go. So, so that's its original form. And what happened is that Strauss wrote incidental music to insert into Le Bourgeois Gentil. They regrouped, and in 1916, what was suggested is that Strauss take all of Bourgeois Gentil and condense it into what's called a prologue. So it really changes the weight of who's important in the story. But what they were trying to do right from the beginning is to show the challenges of producing and tragedy versus comedy. And what does the audience really want to see? With the idea that, yes, let's put on this great Greek tragedy, Ariadne, off Naxos, but nobody's going to want to come. So we need to put some Commedia dell'arte characters in there to make sure people laugh, and so, and sell some popcorn in the lobby. So if we sell some popcorn in the lobby and have some comedic characters, they'll stay for the Greek tragedy. That's my contemporary way of sort of saying what the statement that they're trying to make here. But what happened is then Strauss magically blended these two storylines together. The Ariadne part of it, the Ariadne auf Naxos part of it, is actually, I believe, the Ariadne, yes, is sung by Lisa Davidson, who's amazing. And Bacchus is a guy named Brandon Jovanovich. Their voices are extraordinary, and you will think that you're listening to Wagner, because Strauss is an ongoing late romantic extension of Wagner. The size of the voices, the extension of the melodies, the kind of idea that there's not a set aria in the same way that's identifiable to the audience as there is in Rigoletto. But the real vocal, star for the audience ends up being Zerbinetta of the Commedia dell'arte. So Strauss composed this in many ways perfectly to identify the audience's attraction to a character. And it's one of it's a rafter blowing kind of coloratura aria with high Fs all around. I mean, it's pièce de résistance. It's something that coloraturas aim to try to perform sometime in their career. But it's a very complex work. And you really should see this Met HD, because you need a major company to bring a work like this to life and have it be everything that Strauss intended it to be.
Well, you know, but speaking of, you know, gigantic operas, we moved to Don Carlos, Giuseppe Verdi's, and, you know, this is a heavy hitter.
It's Verdi's longest opera, coming in at just under 5 hours, I think the production is, you said, Tom. I was thinking
I believe
four
so.
And a half, but I think there's is pushing to 4:45, which makes total sense. Magnificent production. I have a statement that I'll say with my students a lot, which is, do your homework before you go to see this. Mm-hmm. And people perceive going to the theater, not just opera, but maybe opera in a more pointed way, differently. Sometimes people want to go the first time and just to experience it and be hit with it, if you will, and take away from it what they do. I think that is a great way to go in many cases, but I'm not sure Don Carlo is the one that you want to just go, because there's so much information about its historic connections. There's so many, I'll call them secondary characters, but they're not really, that are vital to this spider web of destruction of individuals' lives that are part of this. It's based on history. I mean, that's what's interesting. It's historically based, but of course in an Italian operatic romantic way with a lot of extensions to that. But the premise is that Don Carlo, who is Flemish, and who are being, it's during the time of the Inquisition, is in love with Elizabeth de Valois, and he's going to go to Fontainebleau, and is in love with her, wants to marry her, as was the time terribly for so long. She is promised to marriage to King Philip of the Second of Spain. The Flemish and the Spaniards are enemies, so you add to the love conflict, a political conflict, and it's an interesting connection back to the Rigoletto in the sense of how the people around those in power manipulate the information that they learn, who they tell this secret to or that secret to, who falsifies information, so that the two primary figures actually don't receive accurate information to make their own best decision. And Elizabeth is unable to make her own best decision because of the times and how she's utilized as a pawn. The most famous music in this is the famous duet between Carlo and Rodrigo. Rodrigo is his friend. He's also Flemish. And he tells Rodrigo of his love for Elizabeth. And it turns in, it's one of the all-time great operatic tunes, if you will, where they pledge their friendship and, you know, vow to protect the interests of their country.
And it's sung in French with English subtitles again. And am I correct I believe that the Met's music director is going to be the conductor as well. Yannick Nesse-Segni.
He is. He yeah. is. And he is French. And it was originally written in French, hence the length, because the time in which it was written also include a famous ballet, as was necessitated in the French style of the time. Almost simultaneously, it was also written in Italian, so it could be performed in Italy, but they're going back to the original French, which is the more extensive version.
Any the voices, I imagine, are
well, probably I'm a huge terrific. Fan. I'll just give away my secret. So I'm in love with Matthew Pulisani, who's singing Carlo. If for people who listen to the Met a lot, Matthew Pulisani is, you'll hear him in many, many productions. I won't take the time now to list them all, but it's an absolutely extraordinary voice. He's a marvelous actor. And in this one, I think because of the importance of the duet, which is a real staple of people are learning their operatic music staples, the Rodrigo is a French singer, Etienne Dupuis. And so what I love is this inclusion of, again, French native speakers, French educational heritage, as you're creating a work from its original French style.
That's it for part one of this interview. In our next episode, Julie and I will talk about the remaining three operas coming later in the spring: Turandot, Lucia de Lammermoor, and Hamlet. You'll want to be sure to tune in for part two. As always, more information is available on the website at www.fredopera.org or by calling the Opera House box office at 716-679-1891. And that's it for this New Year edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Paul Preston and Julie Newell for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. We'll return in 2 weeks on January 19th. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.